This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sianne Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
I am Anne Applebaum. I'm the Director of the Transitions Forum at the Legarten Institute, and I am talking to Fiona Hill of the Brookings Institution, who has just republished her book, which is called Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, which is both a biography, a personal biography, and a political biography of Vladimir Putin. Nice to have you here, Fiona.
Thanks, Anne.
So, in republishing your book, I know that you've now, it was originally published in 2012?
That's correct, yes. So end of 2012, beginning of 2013.
Right, but a lot has happened since 2013, and I know that you've updated the book to include a new section on Putin's new foreign policy. Or is it a new foreign policy? Do you think from what we saw, from what you know of his life, are you surprised by what's happened in the last year?
Not entirely, but to some degree there is a new element to this. When Putin first came into office, if we think back 15 years ago, now it's actually kind of astounding to think this has really been 15 years, he actually made no pronouncements whatsoever on foreign policy. So it was always a bit hard at the very beginning of his presidency to figure out quite what he was going to be about in the foreign policy realm. He was talking much more about the restoration of the Russian state, you know, putting Russia back as a great power in global affairs, but that's quite vague. But as time went on through the presidency, he did start to make more and more pronouncements on foreign policy. And I think it became very clear in 2007, when Putin made a very famous speech at the Munich Security Conference, that he was starting to see the West, and the United States in particular, and of course NATO and other Western institutions, as a threat to Russian interests. It wasn't completely articulated as to how he was going to respond to this, but I think we got something of a hint of that, or something much more than a hint, in the war in Georgia in 2008. Now, of course, that's been interpreted in different ways outside in the West, in part because of the mishandling of the relationship with Russia by Mikhail Saakashvili and the Georgian government of the time. But it was very clear that Putin and those around him were making a statement back in 2008 that they saw as unacceptable the aspiration of many of the neighbouring countries, those that had been at once part of the Soviet Union or of the Russian Empire, to gain entry into Western institutions like NATO and to have close associations with the United States. And so what we've seen in Ukraine has been a kind of, not a culmination, I would say, but a more extreme version of that same policy trend that was really emerging as much as 7 years ago with the Munich speech, where Putin talked about the threats from NATO and the threats that he saw in his neighbourhood. And really, it has become, you know, very much, I would say, concentrated now in this conflict in Ukraine. What has been really new about this is really the kind of emotion in the rhetoric and the sort of almost sense of hysteria that has emerged in Moscow about this threat, this fear of regime change. And what I think was the tipping point with this was the opposition protests in 2011 against the parliamentary elections and then against Putin deciding himself to come back as being the president, where people were on the streets of Moscow and other major cities asking for more choice, more political choice. And what we've got now seems to be a president in Russia, and the person of Vladimir Putin, who fears that his regime will be overthrown and who has started to interpret every event, every change in circumstances somehow directed against him. Seeing what happened with the fall of Yanukovych in Ukraine as being directed against Russia, having nothing to do with any kind of internal Ukrainian developments, being an outside plot. Seeing his own opposition movement as being directed from the outside, it's either the CIO, it's MI6, or some kind of Western plot, and interpreting every event in that context. And so we're actually now in a state that would have been actually somewhat hard to predict, even with these events of 2007 onwards, of open confrontation with the West, and Putin seeing himself at war with the West.
So in other words, he really sees foreign policy as a kind of extension of domestic policy, that what he's doing is protecting his own power. You know, in a way, the war in Ukraine is his way of preventing something like something similar than that happening at home. And I asked that because I'd pick up on one of your points. You know, you said in 2007 he made this speech about not wanting Russia's immediate neighbors to join Western institutions. You know, that seems to me a very interesting point because, in fact, as you know, NATO had no interest in that region and was downsizing throughout the early part of throughout the 2000s, and you know, getting rid of troops and pulling back tanks and becoming smaller and smaller. So it was almost sort of odd that Putin chose the last several years to begin to perceive the West as some kind of real threat. And the only conceivable explanation is that it was something internal, because...
That's right, yeah. I do agree with that. I mean, I think it's kind of, in a way, an overinterpretation on the part of Putin and those around him of events in the West. Because absolutely, NATO, in terms of being a real military force inside of Europe, was really diminishing. I mean, in terms of, as you're absolutely saying, everyone is cutting their defence budgets. The United States is pulling back from bases. But what they are looking at from the point of view of Moscow is this expansion of NATO as a club, of NATO as an alliance. So we're bringing in, after 2004, a larger number of European countries that were once parts of the Warsaw Pact organisation, and then at least opening the door to Georgia and Ukraine and other countries in the immediate neighbourhood. And Putin and the people around him seem to have conflated these issues and to sort of see really a kind of a threat that was not there. Because Putin at Munich and at later stages keeps talking about NATO remaining a military alliance and having to be directed against some other entity.
Even
though this case. And so not actually buying the explanations from NATO that were being carried out in this NATO-Russian Council, that in fact NATO was actually looking to Russia to be more of a partner organisation in the way that Israel and all kinds of other countries have become partners of NATO within the immediate neighbourhood. And Putin and the people around him never seem to have bought that. In fact, they seem to have been almost insulted in strange ways by the idea that they're no longer the kind of the military threat that they were seen as before. So we're sort of seeing a creation of a self-fulfilling prophecy, of a failure to recognise that NATO is going in different directions. The expansion of NATO is more about an expansion of an association of countries who are sharing a similar outlook on security. And NATO was talking about humanitarian issues and acting out of area. And of course, there was all of the activity in Afghanistan. But Putin continues to seeing this as actually an institution that is directed in the European arena and that is somehow projected and directed always against Russia.
Right, and which nobody in Europe thought.
Absolutely, and we failed somehow to get this across at all points.
Or they didn't want to hear it.
And then after a certain point, they've convinced themselves more and more that this is in fact the threat that they were looking for all along. And of course now they have the threat that they were perceiving in the reaction from NATO and from all of the European players to what they have done in Crimea, with the annexation of Crimea and the war in Ukraine. NATO is, in fact, particularly as at the Wales summit last September, back to thinking that they have to focus on European security arena and building back up again the defences.
You've written a lot about Putin's early life and his earlier career. To what extent does his KGB training and KGB background affect his outlook? How does he see the world?
You see, I think it really plays into this. Look, we don't know a great deal, however, about what Putin was doing in the KGB. We know, of course, that he had this career in the KGB. We don't know a lot of the details. I mean, obviously, it's hard to discern these. But what we do know is the period of time that he was in the KGB, and we can kind of think about some of the things that were happening in that. And for me, what is instructive when it comes to this point about the worldview and about seeing the threats is to think back to the 1980s. When Putin has already begun his career in the KGB, and he actually goes to the Red Banner Institute, the KGB Academy in Moscow, and appeared in the 1980s, and then he's posted to Dresden from 1985 to 1990. And that timing is very important. On the one hand, he misses perestroika back home in the Soviet Union when he's posted in Dresden, so the whole debates about a new foreign policy and a new way of governing the whole system and all of the debates about the sins of the past and all of the challenges that Russia faces in the present and in the future. So he misses being part of that action of really kind of addressing what's happening at home. But he also is in Dresden and also in the KGB Academy just before that, at the height of the war scare from the 1980s. I mean, a lot of people are going to find this hard to remember, but there was a big crisis in Western relations with the Soviet Union at that point over the SS-20 Pershing missile basing in Europe. And the KGB was put on alert by Yuri Andropov from between about 1981 to 1984, looking for any evidence of a first nuclear strike by the United States. This is against the backdrop of the Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, Ronald Reagan. And basically, against the kind of backdrop of when we were really at that point where we seemed to be coming to the climax of our confrontation, nuclear confrontation with Russia. And we know for a fact now that the Soviet leadership and the KGB were convinced that there would be a first strike by the United States, because we now have the archival material from East Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And a lot of this is actually available in the public domain. The CIA actually has a public website for the Center for Intelligence Studies, and they have all this material there. And you can see that the KGB really was on alert, looking for any kind of signs. So this is the environment that Putin goes into when he goes to Dresden. They're seeing themselves as forward deployed, looking for all kinds of evidence, not just stealing technological secrets or trying to kind of get into the heads of Western business people and figuring out, you know, what's happening in the economy, which is sort of the conventional wisdom. But they're also out there looking to what the US might be doing and trying to use the back door from East to West Germany as to any kind of signs about US intent. And it's only when Gorbachev comes along, you know, a little bit later into that time frame, and starts to kind of de-escalate the confrontation, and we start on the negotiations with Reykjavik and all the kind of Moscow meetings that lead to the INF Treaty, that kind of sense of threat goes down. And I think, you know, against that kind of backdrop, it's easy for Putin to start to see those threats, to go back into that kind of mindset of the 1980s, and to see the US again and the West and NATO as that major adversary. And another point of this is, when he kind of rises to the top of the KGB, of course, he's appointed to the top of the KGB in that period of 1998-1999. That's against the backdrop of the NATO bombing of Belgrade during the Yugoslav wars. And Putin is appointed at that point, this is part of his meteoric rise to becoming the president, to head up the Russian Security Council. And he's right there in the thick of all the interactions with NATO, and clearly, you know, sort of seeing that again as a major threat.
What do you think was the significance of 1989 for him? Some people have pointed to that experience. He was actually in Germany at the time the wall fell in East right. Germany. Some people have pointed to this as a kind of fundamental experience for him. Would you agree with that?
I would. Actually, he expresses that in his own words. I mean, we all always have to take with a little bit of a pinch of salt what Putin says, but sometimes it's extremely instructive. And a lot of the biographical materials that we have on him, the interviews that he's given with various Russian journalists right at the very beginning of his presidency, he talks with great regret about that period, about Russia losing its position, or the Soviet Union losing its geopolitical position in Europe. And it seems to have been a time of great personal humiliation for him, at the kind of basically the loss of this great power status of the Soviet Union. I mean, it's much later that he talks about the great catastrophe of the 20th century being the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's not at that particular juncture. He says this later in other speeches. But he does talk about his perceptions about how the Soviet Union just retreated from Europe with a whimper, you know, with not even, you know, with a bang, or kind of going out in some kind of fashion, just sort of disappearing. And you get that kind of sense from those statements that he wants to put Russia back in Europe, and is acknowledged as being a major player in Europe that has to be treated with due respect and caution, like it was in the Cold War, and that Russia having a right as one of the great powers globally, not just one of the major powers in Europe, to veto the decisions that are taken that are contrary to Russia's interests. And I guess that, you know, what we're seeing in Ukraine now is the ultimate demand for a veto. No, Ukraine is not going to go in this direction, and we're going to make sure that they do not.
And are there no voices in Russia that say, actually, it would be good for us if Ukraine was in Europe, and it would be good for us to have the borders of a, you know, relatively prosperous, you know, free trade zone come closer to ours? Has that feeling been extinguished?
I think that feeling has really faded. Whether it's been entirely extinguished or not is another matter. It's hard to tell under the current environment, particularly with the emotions so high in Moscow. I think there were quite a few business interests and economic interests in Russia that actually thought that Ukraine being somewhat in the EU orbit in terms of the kind of customs agreements and tariff agreements and others would be very beneficial for Russian business. And in fact, you could see in the run-up to all the deliberations of Ukraine about an association agreement, a lot of Russian firms moving in to set up a kind of a base from which they were going to obviously trade more intensively with the EU, that they were going to kind of basically up their presence in the EU using Ukraine as a back door. So there was an idea of kind of a bridge. But I think there was never really any feeling that Ukraine should be firmly within the European Union. So at some point along the way, of course, this was highly unlikely that Ukraine was going to be in the European Union anyway, but somewhere in 2013, Moscow and Putin and the people around him to start to actually see that there's more to be lost from this than to be gained. And it's a bit hard to pinpoint exactly what was really the kind of the turning point.
I was just
going
to ask you, because there are different theories as to what exactly tipped the balance. Because, of course, when Yanukovych was elected, the former president of Ukraine was elected, he was arguing in favor of joining the, or signing an association agreement.
Yeah.
Nobody's asked him to join the EU. And as far as anybody understood, all the people who were negotiating that from the European side, Russia approved.
Yeah.
What happened?
I think Russia was hoping that this would be kind of more of a fudge, you know, that this would be kind of, Yanukovych would sign on to some sort of provisions association agreement and would also join the Eurasian Union. And I think it's at that time when it seems
that
it might have been possible. Yeah. But when it becomes clear that this DCFTA, this Deep Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement on a technical level doesn't permit you to be in two of these arrangements simultaneously fully, that's when the Russians start to worry. And I think that, you know, they thought that they might be able to, pull off some kind of, it's hard to say quite what they had in mind, but some fuzzy arrangement where, you know, kind of maybe the Ukrainians would backpedal a bit on the association agreement and be able to join the Eurasian Union. And then suddenly it seemed that maybe that wasn't going to work out. And of course, that's when the crisis starts to unfold in Ukraine itself. Yanukovych was trying to play every side off against each other and then failed spectacularly because of the way he had totally and utterly mismanaged the political and economic and, you know, general socioeconomic system at home.
Yeah, I've been starting to wonder whether it wasn't Putin's internal problems that made him do that. In other words, that at that particular moment, as you say, in the wake of demonstrations and, you know, rightly or wrongly fears for his own, you know, political stability, maybe political legitimacy, he decided to change tactics and decided to block Ukraine.
Yes,
and that wasn't a piece of the part of the decision.
Right, and to try to pull Ukraine much more firmly into the Eurasian Union. I think at that particular point, he's probably getting an awful lot of bad news from the economic domain, from his economic advisors, because, of course, the crisis in the Eurozone is continuing and Russia's starting to get affected by this. There's all been all the warnings about the oil price going down and what impact this is going to have on the Russian economy. So all of these kinds of things, along with the concerns about the political situation at home, the role of the opposition, you know, were they really going to get any more traction? Plus all kinds of other things that are going on externally in the outside world make the situation much more unpredictable. And I think Putin definitely wanted to make sure that Ukraine was firmly in Russia's orbit and not, you know, kind of in some fuzzy grey area where there might be much more of the attraction pulling towards the European Union. And I think then when they saw this as groundswell of support coming from Ukraine of doing things differently, that was also deeply threatening. Because it really was more of a grassroots movement, whether Putin believes it or not, of a groundswell of people saying, we don't want to be governed like this. We want to do something different. We don't want to look like Russia. Actually, we have a pole of attraction elsewhere. And Putin has been banking on the fact that Russia always looks actually much more attractive to Ukrainians than Ukraine itself. But then suddenly there's a prospect of going somewhere else or looking in a different direction and maybe starting to implement new reforms, doing something differently. And he was relying on Yanukovych to keep all of this under check. And Yanukovych proves to be spectacularly inept. And that's where we also then get the paranoia that Yanukovych is being, you know, manipulated from the West. You know, the kind of images of, you know, Western interactions with Yanukovych, people trying to play politics. There's the whole crisis about Yulia Tymoshenko and about her coming out of jail. And, you know, there's all sorts of machinations are going on. And I think probably from the perspective of Moscow, they feel like they were losing their control of the situation. But again, it's hard to kind of really pinpoint because, of course, one of the big problems that we all have from the outside is it's very difficult to penetrate what's really happening in the decision-making circles. This is why the situation we have is so dangerous. And we have much more sense, obviously, of what's going on in our own polities, of all the kinds of interactions, we're much more transparent in terms of the debates. And we really have very little idea of what's going on in the huddle around Putin, the kind of collective Putin, and how the decisions are being made and what it is becomes the tipping factor.
Mm-hmm. One final question. When Putin was in his first two terms as president, in effect, he had a kind of bargain with the Russian people. In other words, I will give you stability. There will be economic growth, and in exchange for that, we have a little bit less democracy, in fact, a lot less democracy, and you accept the fact that elections are manipulated and media is controlled and so on. Now we're in a slightly different moment where the economy is not stable. In fact, it's very unstable. Has Putin really lost, has he lost hope in that bargain? Is he not going to try does he not take this seriously as a concern? I mean, many of the moves that he's made recently, his response to sanctions being, for example, to block Western food imports, which was an absolute own goal. Has he lost his direction on the economy completely?
I don't think so. It's just that I don't think he's looking at the economy in the way that we would look at it. What Putin is obviously very concerned about is how much money they have internally for the budget. He's also, of course, very much concerned externally about the amount of reserves, and that's why we've seen some kind of pretty strange moves on, from, you know, basically what would be a Western rational economic reaction of letting the central bank, you know, try to, you know, basically defend the currency. For Putin, the currency reserves, the foreign currency reserves, are like a strategic asset that are as important as nuclear weapons or the military. Because when he came into office back in 1999-2000, Russia was bankrupt. It had no foreign reserves to speak of. And for Putin, that's the way that you kind of play globally, by having basically a large set of wealth funds and foreign exchange reserves. And domestically, it's the same kind of idea. As long as you've got money in the budget, you can do things. And so in sort of perverse ways, some of the things that have happened actually help the budget. The falling oil price, of course, is pretty detrimental because you get much less revenues coming into the Russian budget. But at the same time, as oil is still indexed in dollars, you know, when the ruble devalues, you actually have more rubles. You know, so there's kind of a bit of a flip side to that kind of issue. But also by blocking some of the imports, you're not spending an awful lot of money on expensive imports, and you're trying to kind of push import substitution to sort of stimulate the local economy. Of course, that's not going to happen very quickly, so of course it doesn't look too good in the short term. But what Putin is going to do is really prioritise from out of that, you know, those budget revenues, the rubles that you have, all of the ruble spending that is really essential for that bargain with at least his core constituency. It's not a bargain anymore with the professional white-collar class, all the people who are out there being, as he says, national traitors by protesting in Moscow back in 2011 and 2012. It's all about supporting the pensioners and the workers in the defence industrial complex and all the people who make things that are still the stuff of kind of the Russian heavy industrial sector. And, you know, presumably in the oil and gas sector, people kind of take care of themselves as a very small part of the workforce. And, you know, as the oil price goes back up, that sector will, you know, be lifted as well. But he's going to be prioritising making sure that his core constituency in the regions where they have to be subsidised, the pensioners and the core industrial workers all have their wages paid, and then of course the bureaucracy, the people who are dependent on the state sector. So while he has money in the budget, you know, in rubles, he feels quite comfortable about this, but in ways that we wouldn't be. I mean, he's talking down the economy, talking down people's expectations, preparing people for harder times ahead. They're not going to have rising wages and rising incomes, but then there's going to be a lot less to buy, you know, in terms of kind of durable goods from the West. So it's kind of a complex game that he's trying to play to kind of keep up that part of the bargain. Now, whether that works or not is another matter. But I think Putin is banking on the fact that that will work for some period of time, particularly if they control the message about, look, this is the West doing this to you. This is not us having mismanaged the economy. This is, you know, you're being punished. We, Russia, are being punished by the West with these sanctions. Punished, as he keeps saying, for our independent position, for defending our interests, for defending Ukraine against fascism, for dealing with this illegitimate coup in Ukraine. And this is our punishment, so we have to withstand this. And as long as he can keep that message and people keep believing it, you know, he feels that he can manage this situation. The question is, how sustainable is that? And that, of course, that depends an awful lot on things like oil price and about what happens next in the global economy, not just on the issue of sanctions.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Anne.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.